Hello, everybody. I'm Brian Levine, and welcome to The Gould Standard, a podcast brought to you by the Glenn Gould Foundation. We bring you conversations with some of the most remarkable people from all across the world of the arts. If music, poetry, film, visual arts, theater, novels, or dance are the pause that refreshes in your life, come on in for a conversation that will take the heat off like a soothing breeze on a stifling summer day. Now, while you're stopping by under our flashing neon sign, please do take a moment to press like, share, and subscribe. And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please kindly leave your reviews, pose your questions, and be part of our community of friends and supporters. And to get more simply wonderful words, images, and sounds, you can pay a visit to our website, glenngould.ca. And while you're there, you will undoubtedly notice a donate sign. We are a registered Canadian charity, and we rely on the support of arts lovers like you, so please do give generously. Now, today, our guest is a true original, arguably the most famous tattoo artist who has ever lived, but she's also a musician, a TV personality, she's been a fabulously successful makeup entrepreneur, a best-selling author, a social media sensation, with all that entails, both good and sometimes bad. And now she is making her presence noted with her line of all-vegan fashion shoes. But if that weren't enough, she's about to release her very first album. Our guest today is the one and only Kat Von D. Now, Kat has been an outspoken supporter of animal rights and the vegan lifestyle, and she's embraced the world of handmade crafts and art objects in her own life and surroundings. Oh, and by the way, while her persona may be associated with the worlds of goth and punk, she's also a pianist, schooled in classical music, and an ardent admirer of Beethoven and Glenn Gould. I first met Kat 5 years ago, and we had a great conversation then, and I was keen to catch up with her because there have been huge changes in her life since that time. I wanted to get her reflections on her new directions and find out what creative adventures lie ahead. Kat, welcome to the Gould Standard. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me, Brian.
I find it hard to believe that it's been about 5 years since we last spoke. There have been some huge changes. Tell us a bit about some of the big shifts.
Well, I think when we first met, I obviously didn't have a baby, and now I do. My son is 3 years old. Oh, he's going to be 3 in November, so it's been an exciting journey into motherhood and parenting, so that's always a life changer in a good way. But yeah, as you said before, like, I'm about to release an album and really refocusing my efforts into the music. So it's kind of a strange time to do that, but an exciting time nonetheless.
And of course, you're now, as they say, a married lady.
Yes.
So your wedding took place during that time as well. Lots of huge changes.
Yeah, I think I was about 4 or 5 months pregnant when we got married. That's not why we got married, but I just happened to be pregnant at the time. We just celebrated our 3 years, so it's pretty awesome.
Right, and of course the shoe business since then, right?
Yeah, I have a vegan shoe line that people seem to like, and that's a good thing always. But yeah, just trying to create like cruelty free fashion options for people. And you've been busy.
Believe me, you know, there are always things for the wicked to do.
Yeah.
I mean, I want to really talk about your album. And, you know, the first track was released as a music video just a little over a month ago, and you've already had over 1 million views on YouTube. So that's pretty smashing. Tell us what the genesis, because this has been a long time in coming, hasn't it?
It has. I actually wrote the album about 10 years ago. And I think life just kind of tends to get in the way of life sometimes. You know, I was doing a TV show and then a book tour and then launching the makeup line and all that stuff. And it just, everything kind of took precedence over releasing music. And so I tended to shelve what I had written for so long. And then I think once I sold my makeup line, I was like, finally, I can have the time to tour and to properly release it and start writing again. So, you know, it did take some time to release this album, but we're already writing album number 2 so that we won't have to wait this long next time. I think a lot of my fans and my followers, they know me for all the things that they've seen, and they don't know that I do have a musical history. Music to me is my first passion, really. It's influenced everything else that I've done. And I hope people can pick that up. And when they see my tattooing or when they see what I create, There's so much music influence behind it. And so, although I didn't write a classical music album, I have classical music to thank for my ability to be able to play the piano and to compose my style of music. And my band is a pretty heavy into synths, like synthesizers. And well, Sammy Doll, she likes more the computer stuff. And Greg is more on the analog side. Everything is, it's an instrument. It's not programmed. It's not a preset. And so there's a lot of beautiful sound design that goes into that. But when you strip it down, everything started with just a piano. And I think that's some of my favorite music is always the stuff that you can play acoustically.
Well, so much easier if you're going to tour it.
Yeah.
Well, look, the first music video, the first track, is Exorcism, and it looks like the video was shot in the middle of the desert. Where did you do it, and what went into creating that, and did you all bake?
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh. It was so hot. And we always wore black and everything. I was wearing latex stockings that were just melting onto my skin. It was torture. But the things we do for art, the music video for Exorcism, I wrote and directed that one. And to me, it was a really great way to introduce my bandmates because they're such star players and they obviously had such a big role in making this album with me. And, you know, they're rock stars in their own right. And I feel like together, when we come together, we're just such a strong group. And so I wanted to create this idea of showcasing their supernatural abilities and them flying through the air and joining me on this mission. We actually had a stunt crew that came out, and those were actual real stunts. I told my bandmates, we're not getting you guys stunt doubles. You got to do your own stunts. And they were so excited. They're like, oh my God, I'm going to fly today. In post, we had to take out all the strings that were, you know, suspending them through the air. And that was really exciting. I always like looked at, well, one of my favorite directors is Alejandro Jodorowsky. He did like The Holy Mountain and El Topo and Santa Sangre. And I loved his, you know, the juxtapositions of scenes that he used to do where you would see like a cowboy in all black riding a black horse through the desert with like an old Victorian umbrella. And you see that silhouette of something that doesn't belong there. And so I really liked that idea of incorporating, you know, that was like me paying homage to him.
Well, that's great.
In a way.
You should let him know. He's, I think, about 80 now, but he's still with us.
Yeah.
He'd probably love that. Will there be some other individual tracks coming out before the album?
Yes. So we just released our second single called I Am Nothing, and we'll be releasing the music video for that next Wednesday. So I'm excited about that. And Linda Strawberry directed that one. And I just always, I loved all the work that she did with Smashing Pumpkins and with all of her other creative directing debuts that are just so beautiful. Like she has such a way of making things look very romantic and very rich and saturated. So it'll be a lot different than the Exorcism music video. And then after that, we'll be releasing two more tracks before the album comes out in August. So
fabulous.
A pretty heavy schedule.
It's a heavy schedule, but it must feel like the time is right because you've been in development, as they say in the film biz, for a long time. And I'm really glad for you that it's
thank you.
Seeing the light of day now. But you made a comment about your background early on in classical music, and I'd like to go back to your earlier life and kind of trace where those influences came in. Now, you were born in Mexico, and your family, they were in the Seventh-day Adventist Church. They came to California. But do you have any memories of your early years in Mexico?
Oh, yeah, of course. So my family, they're actually from Argentina, and they were doing missionary work in Mexico before we moved to America. And that's where myself and my siblings were born. And it's funny because, I mean, of course, I remember elements of my childhood. We didn't come to the U.S. until I was six. So, you know, there's some very vivid memories from Mexico, and I returned there a lot. I still have family that lives in Mexico. So the interesting part about it, as far as music goes, like we've just always been a musical family. And going to church, we were obviously singing in choir and things like that. But for whatever reason, my parents were very adamant about having music musical instruments in within the household. So everybody played at least two instruments. And I think, thankfully, my grandmother, who's a pianist, was, you know, because we were pretty poor. It's not like we had much money. So she was able to give us piano lessons, you know, every week. And I stuck to it. My siblings, they don't play music anymore, but I still play piano every single day. And I'm really grateful for that gift. You know, I remember as a child, like sitting, because we were sent to the Adventist, we kept the Sabbath. And so every Friday when the sun would come down, our family would gather in the living room and, you know, someone was at an instrument and we would play together. And I think that element of family is so important. And I think now as having a child, I see how important those things are. And I've brought those familial traits into our household. You know, we eat together, you know, we pray together, we spend time together. Weekends for us is family day. So I'd steer away from doing too much work on the weekends for the most part. And I think just having those bonding moments with no electronics, no distractions, it's just so crucial and something that's missing in a lot of people's lives, especially out here in LA. I really trip out on that, like how we've kind of lost connection to family.
Yeah.
And music for us was our bonding agent, you know? It was something that we enjoyed doing together more than anything else, I think.
And a lot of that connection with classical music especially came from your grandmother Clara, right?
Yeah, that's right. And she loved all the greats. I don't know if I ever told you about the little book that she gave me. Did I ever tell you the story about this?
No.
So one of my most prized possessions is this little scrapbook that my grandma made when she was a teenager. And she basically took articles, some of them were in German, some of them were in Spanish. There were articles from some newspapers and clippings of all of her favorite composers, the Beethoven, Mozart, Chopin. And then she was also a painter and she drew really well. She was an artist. So she would draw these little portraits and then write her feelings about each composer and a little history about them. There was a lot of romanticized stories about Beethoven, like how he wrote Moonlight Sonata and all this stuff. Some of it, I don't know how true it was. But that was basically like her book of heartthrobs.
Oh, wow. That's great.
You know, it's, yeah. And so, you know, she's 98 now, I think, 99 maybe.
Oh, wow. That's fantastic.
Yeah. And then a few years ago, she gave me that book, which was kind of a big deal to me, at least. And so I have it behind a glass case in the library. And like, it's one of my most, you know, worthless to anyone else, but to me, it's really important. But I used to pore over this book, and I think that's one of the reasons I fell in love with Beethoven was not only just the music, but just the life story. And that's the same thing that happened when I was introduced to Glenn Gould. It was like, of course, he's amazing. I mean, what, no one else like him. But I think the personal aspect of his life and struggles and stuff is something that I connected a lot more deeply to his music because of it. I remember watching that BBC documentary about him. I just remember him playing at the Chickering with his dog, listening. And then he went on into talking about performing live. And he seemed kind of like an outsider in ways, you know? And I think that to me, maybe because I've always been an outsider, it resonates with me a lot more. Same with Beethoven.
You know, I want to talk a little bit more about that outsider feeling and the whole ethos of it. But I, since you mentioned the Chickering, I don't know whether you can see over my shoulder, but that is actually the piano that Glenn owned before the Chickering.
This
His first piano, the one that his mother...
Oh, I love your life.
If you open up the lid on the top, he signed it on the inside.
That is so amazing.
Yeah.
That's...
See, another reason for you to come to Toronto. I will give you a guided tour.
Yes.
Anyway, so were you raised in Spanish?
Yeah. So my first language was Spanish, and we were doing the same with my son. Like, we only speak to him in Spanish, and now he's bilingual just by nature. And I remember that's what happened to us. We came to the U.S. We didn't speak any English whatsoever. I think our parents put us into kindergarten. They said you came back speaking English, and it was such a gift, you know, to be able to be bilingual. And so we really want to share that with Leofar, our son. And
right.
Yeah. So it's pretty awesome to see him speaking in both.
But obviously you were an extremely receptive child because your English is accent free. I'm sure your Spanish, of course, is perfectly accented too. So you obviously are a great learner. You're 6 years old. You're in California. Obviously a very different kind of background to be growing up in. Is that where you first began to have that outsider feeling that you were drawn in a different direction, maybe from other kids?
I mean, I think I always felt different even within my own family unit. I think, I don't know what it was. I didn't suffer any abuse. I didn't, you know, we had a very loving household. My parents were quite strict about things, but I don't feel like I missed out on much. You know, I didn't know what MTV was until I, you know, was in my late teens.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I was better for it. You know, I ended up focusing more on my artwork and stuff. But I think it was like a feeling inside. You know, I just didn't really feel like I belonged in a lot of ways. And then when I discovered punk rock music, it was kind of like an introduction to the voice inside. You know, it's like, oh, okay, there's other people out there that feel the same way. I have always looked weird to the normal, but I never did it as a form of rebellion. I never wanted it to piss off my parents by getting tattoos. My heart went out to them that they didn't understand why I felt the need to do that. They were pretty heartbroken about it. And to me, it was just this form of self-expression that I did for myself.
Right.
And it wasn't anything you can really control, you know, like even when I'm writing music, it's the same way. I don't sit there writing, okay, what would people like or what would so-and-so think about it? You know, I don't, I just write what I feel like. It's like you have to, not because you want to, you know?
And that's an interesting thing about punk, because, you know, a lot of people who aren't deep into punk or, you know, for whom, you know, it's now a bit of a distant memory from, you know, the old days.
Yeah.
You know, they associate it with anger and a certain level of violent rebellion.
Well, a lot
and
of
a certain
it is.
Political. Yeah. But there's also the feeling of alienation and creating a community among alienated people.
I mean, and I don't listen to punk rock music anymore, to be honest. I mean, there's some, like, if it, you know, I love the Misfits and things like that, but I wouldn't choose to listen to the Germs or Noise. I think I've grown up since then, you know, and I think it was almost like that music was age appropriate for me at that time. And then once I discovered like metal, I really responded to metal more because of the classical influence. You know, when you look, when you listen to like a guitar riff, oh, I'm like, oh, that's a scale. This is classical music. And people want to dismiss it as not music. But in reality, I'm like, it takes so much skill to play the way that they do. And then after that, I started getting more into real songwriting, romantic, post-punk, more the goth stuff. You know, I love like Susie and the Banshees and The Cure, Depeche Mode. And you started really like hearing vocals, like, you know, soulful vocals. And the lyrics were such a huge part of the music. So it was true poetry. And that is what I listen to now. You know, it's like, I still, like, I feel like that's what I really respond to. And that's where I belong. And at that point, you don't really care about the alienation part because you're too busy dealing with your own, you know, feelings and your own, the things that matter more, you know, instead of what other people care about.
You're such a goth toughie. You're a marshmallow romantic at heart.
I am.
Yeah. You know, the one thing I didn't talk about is drawing and art, because obviously that grew as a very powerful creative impulse in you alongside your early music experience. Were you always drawing things?
I was always drawing. And maybe I don't know if that's a genetics thing, because both my grandma and my grandfather on both sides were artists. But I really do think it just comes from my parents nurturing it from an early age. It was just supported. You know, I would draw and they would say, oh, that's amazing. Or you're doing great. Or let me get you some pencils, you know. And so they really nurtured and fed that. My siblings didn't really draw. My sister's artistic in another way, you know, like she's really good at sewing and she's still very creative. I think I just have an obsessive compulsive aspect that just hyper focuses on something I really love, and I just do it over and over and over again, you know.
Right.
And that works for me. So
and that kind of compulsive dedication is what it takes to get good. And
but I think it was meditative. A lot of it was very meditative as a kid. Like I would get lost in a drawing for hours, the same way I would get lost in playing music. But this is a more quiet version of it.
Right, exactly. You don't need earbuds. You just need a pencil and paper.
Yeah.
Age 14, first tattoo, right?
Yeah, that's right. And I started tattooing at the same time.
So you received your first tattoo and then you said, hey, I'd like to give this a try?
Yeah, I think I had friends. You know, I think it's like, it's the old saying of like, show me who you run with and I'll show you who you are, you know.
Right.
And I was hanging out with kids that were tattooing themselves and they loved the same aesthetic. So I think because I had been drawing and I was pretty good at it for a 14-year-old, my friend who had a tattoo machine was like, oh, you should tattoo me. And I was like, okay. And I, like, without thinking, you know, like, there's a permanency aspect to this, you know? You don't think about that when you're 14.
Right.
And I think that was probably a bit of a blessing in a sense that I didn't have the self-doubt instilled that I do now, you know? Now that, like, I know what good is, it can become intimidating, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's hard not to compare yourself in ways. So anyways, yeah, I was like free and wild, and I did my first tattoo and I loved it. It was like this feeling of being at home to me, like, mm-hmm. like this is what I was supposed to do. And I just knew right then and there, I'm going to tattoo. That's what I'm going to do. And I think I was really lucky in that sense, because I think a lot of people wander through life without having a very focused purpose, or maybe they do, but it's chosen for them versus them choosing it for themselves.
Right.
On a conscious or unconscious level. And for me, I was like, it was just crystal clear. Like, I don't want to waste my time doing anything else.
Time slows down. She scrolls through the years, wandering. She's wandering through misled fears.
Well, that's amazing. So you discovered your calling, or at least one of your callings, because you've got others. That early on, and, you know, things sort of just, the lights went on and you said, hey, this is for me. But there's a difference between that moment when you do your first tattoo and going to work full time as a professional tattoo artist. And that happened just 2 years later, right?
Right. Yeah. I got my first, I mean, at the age of 14, I was just tattooing my friends. We were all underage. And so it was like, we couldn't get tattooed. So I had plenty of people to practice on. And, you know, thankfully it was just all little tiny stuff that I'm sure they could get lasered or covered up later.
Yeah.
But then by the time I was 16, I got hired into my first tattoo shop. And the shop owner took a chance on me. He thought my tattoos were crap, but he looked at my drawings and he said, oh, like, there's promise here. Like, your drawings are really great. You just need to, like, learn how to use a real machine and all that stuff. And he had, you know, the patience to help me unlearn a lot of things that I was doing. And that's kind of where it really, really began for me as far as tattooing goes.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So when you're in that, let's call it apprentice phase, mm-hmm. how do you learn without actually, I don't want to put this the wrong way, but disfiguring customers?
Sure. I mean, I was never traditionally apprenticed or anything, but I winged it. And it's not anything I would ever recommend to anybody nowadays. But, you know, I also was working in a pretty bad part of town, and it was a great place for me to start, because mm-hmm. I was starting off with, like, really basic, smaller things, and then later grew. You know, once I moved to LA, there's, like, I don't want to say a higher standard, mm-hmm. but there was just a demand, like a bigger demand for different level of art. By then, I had already gotten, you know, at least a year or two in of practicing. And, you know, I was working in, like, fine line black and gray lettering, like a lot of names, a lot of in memory of, you know, this is like a typical request in this kind of area, you know, where it's like people are experiencing loss, you know, it's a different world than I think what most people are used to. And so it calls for a different artistic approach. Mm-hmm. And I love that. I'm so grateful, because that really shaped my style and aesthetic. You know, I really gravitated towards portraits and fine line. I was doing single needle tattoos. That was pretty challenging compared to, you know, what most other people are doing. And
right.
from an early age. So I still love all the gangster stuff, you know, that's like my favorite.
But that really actually, that resonates with me, because you started in a place where, you know, maybe someone came in and they lost someone to an overdose, or, you know, a disease or whatever,
or got killed.
Or violence. It must have really registered with you that, you know, like, I'm doing something that's helping them to commemorate something extremely precious and raw in their lives. And that carries a lot of responsibility.
I mean, it really doesn't matter what the reason behind the tattoo is. Your responsibility is always so great. I think it's more of an honor that someone chooses you to commemorate a landmark in time like that. You know, I mean, I've never taken that for granted. Yeah. I know that some tattooers don't like that therapeutic aspect of tattooing. For me, I've always connected very deeply with people. And if they want me to be a sounding board, I'm more than happy to do that during our time that we tattooed. I think that's makes the tattoo a little more special too. And I'm also not afraid of talking about death, and I'm not afraid to talk about feelings with people. And I think that's one of the things that I love about people is our ability to feel and experience things, especially the really hard, struggling aspects of life.
Right. Know? That rings a bell that great portrait photographers talk about how important spending time with their subject is beforehand to really get some insights into, you know, what makes them tick, where their emotional core is and so on. And I have to imagine that, you know, even though the amount of time that you have to spend may be limited, that you need to go through some kind of similar process.
Yeah, but I think that, I don't know, for me, it's pretty easy to read people. I'm not saying that I could figure somebody out in a minute, but like if somebody brings you a photograph of somebody and tells you who they are and what happened in two sentences, I have a good level of empathy that I could understand where they might be coming from.
Right.
And, you know, I think that you're right. I think that personality has a lot to do with creating, like if you're doing a collaborative experience with somebody, like even if you're writing a song with somebody or if you're doing a tattoo for somebody, it is collaborative and it's important to match their vision with who they are and with your vision. So,
right.
Or not, you know, you could just do what you want and it'll have a different effect and it could be cool
right.
too. But I like to get to know people.
Now, I hope you won't mind and certainly feel free not to answer, but this might be a little bit more sensitive, but here you are, you've been brought up in a very religious family surrounded by, you know, fine art and culture. And you're now working in a tattoo studio in a fairly seedy and possibly even dangerous part of town. I mean, how did your family react to that? Were they able to understand?
I think they were mortified. You know, I think my dad came to visit me at the shop one time and you could see it in his face that he was just like, what is my daughter doing here? But I think at that point, they've really lost control. You know, I was already supporting myself. It wasn't like I wasn't living at home anymore. Like, so it's one of those things that, you know, I've apologized to them since. And, you know, they're obviously proud of me now. So it's not like, you know, sometimes you just have to go through it. And I'm just grateful that nothing bad did happen because there was a lot of shootings and there was a lot of, like, next door was an arcade that was basically just a front for drug dealers. And, you know, a lot of dangerous people. So I think about my son now and I'm like, I can't even imagine him hanging out at a place like that ever,
right.
You know,
right.
Let alone when you're 16. It had to be hard for them, you know. But at the same time, I think they just didn't really understand thinking outside of the box either, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
They were very much doing what society and what their parents instilled within them. And they're not free thinkers, you know. And I consider myself a free thinker. And I hope my son will be too, you know.
Oh, I think the odds are pretty good. I want to talk a little bit about the breakthrough, you know, when you opened your own studio, but also, you know, became a TV personality. I did my reading.
Yeah.
Throughout human history, tattooing has been present. In fact, the oldest human mummies that exists.
Yeah.
Ötzi the Iceman, 370 BC. I mean, every culture in the world has had tattooing. It's been associated with religion and with ceremonial significance and, you know, self-expression. And then, you know, fast forward into the 20th century, and it's something that sailors get on shore leave. Or that people in one or another counterculture areas get. So there's somehow a...
And then in the 70s, there was like embraced by the biker culture, which I think that's where it started becoming a little more taboo. You know, like people... There's a reason why there's stigmas around tattooing because there's people that you wouldn't necessarily want to hang out with might have tattoos. But I think nowadays it's, you know, I think last time I talked to you 5 years ago, the ratio of women tattooed in America was 1 out of 3. I mean, that's a lot of people tattooed. And so, and it might have gone up since then.
Yes.
So I think it's different now. I think, you know, I've tattooed everybody from the girl who just turned 18 to an 82-year-old woman. And I think that people, well, first of all, the art has really become elevated. I mean, there's just some stuff that you look at and you're like, is that even real? It's just amazing. I've seen reproductions of Caravaggio's and, you know, things like that, portraits that resemble, you know, a loved one. And it's no longer about something negative.
Right.
And although those do still exist, but now it's really been a focus on the art. And then I think with the help of the TV shows, people really started putting meaning into the tattoos. And that, to me, I think made it something even bigger, you know, because I've tattooed some of the most inspiring people with the most inspiring stories. Mm-hmm. And their little tattoo that, you know, might be a little heart to you represents something so much bigger to them. And I think that the storytelling is so such a beautiful thing. And I love that it's become part of our culture now.
Absolutely. And to that end, although certainly I wouldn't put myself in the category of inspiring people, if we ever find ourselves in the same city and you're willing, I would be honored if you would do my first ever tattoo.
I would love that. It would be my honor.
Oh, well, that'll be a landmark for me. And I'm looking forward to it. We're going to make that happen,
yes.
I hope. Okay.
I love that.
what happens first? You have your own studio or you're on television?
Well, it kind of happened simultaneously. So I had been on a TV show in Miami, and then the ratings, people were really responding to me as a character. And so they wanted to give me my own spinoff show. And so in order to do that, I had to open up my own tattoo shop. Mm-hmm. So I opened up my shop and we kind of documented a little bit of it. And then that's when LA Ink came around, the show LA Ink that revolves around my shop. And so we filmed that for, it feels like a century, but for many, many years. So I guess they kind of happened together.
And because we never mind throwing in a plug, of course, it's High Voltage Tattoo in Los Angeles.
Yeah, High Voltage Tattoo.
But I imagine that there's a long waiting list. So
this is my cat, by the way.
Oh, hello.
This is Nietzsche.
Is that Nietzsche?
He just came to say hello.
Now a video star.
Yeah, and now he's purring into the microphone. So hopefully
that. Oh, that's fine. That's fine. Hello, Nietzsche. So at some level, it must have seemed like you were living a dream. You know, you start off tattooing because it's kind of a calling for you and it lives side by side with your love of music and drawing. And then you're on national television in Miami, and then you have your own studio and your own TV series in which, you know, they not only followed the studio, but also, you know, your personal life, because it's part of the whole reality TV ethos.
Yeah.
That's a lot of change for a creator to absorb in a short period of time. How did you manage all that?
I mean, I think I just had to surround myself around good people and friends because, you know, I think a lot of people, when they start becoming famous or known, they can let the hype get to them and it really changes who they are, you know, or brings out a part of them that, you know, would be better left alone. And I don't know. I've just always kind of just remember where I came from. I don't know if I was necessarily living the dream. I think, you know, during that time I was, you know, especially during the beginning of LA Ink, that was right before I became sober. So I was spiraling out of control and, you know, with my drinking and drugs. And so, you know, it wasn't until, let's see, because I'll be celebrating 14 years of sobriety in July.
Wow.
Yeah, July 7th.
Fantastic.
Yeah. But so there were some really dark times, you know, I wouldn't say they were, I was living the dream. I think that I never really wanted to pursue the world of fame or anything like that. I think it just organically happened. And then I kind of just rolled with the punches, you know, and I did my best. I think there was a lot of learning that I had to do throughout that time. But I don't know. I don't think about it too much. Just
right.
I think as long as you're a good person and, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, and bringing some good into the world.
For sure. But, you know, you're in this fast lane, you know, with the, you know, the celebrity people and all that stuff. You're still trying to do creative work that has integrity, but I'm guessing lots of parties, lots of people flattering you, lots of people wanting to get close to you.
Or just a lot of people pulling you in different directions at the same time. Yeah.
Sunday rain on my parade, washed me away.
That must have fed into becoming more and more involved with substances of various kinds. Was it hard to get to get out of that?
I don't think it was easy, but I think it was simple. Like once I made the decision, you know what you have to do. You know, you can't hang out in certain places. You can't hang out with certain people. You know, I had to just go down my phone and delete a lot of numbers and never look back. Again, I'm so grateful that I had a really good support system of friends that knew what I was going through and knew that I needed help and were there to help me along the way. there weren't very many, but there, right. You know, you don't need many. And it's interesting because the minute that I cut out a lot of the people that were in my life for the wrong reasons, it really opened up space to surround yourself with positive people. And I feel like my life became so much more richer the minute I got sober.
Mm-hmm.
It sucked in the beginning, just like any drastic change will do, especially if there's a chemical element to it as well. There's a physical detox that sucks, but
right.
I think the psychological part is a lot harder.
Yeah, exactly. At a certain point, you know, especially early on, every hour or every 15 minutes, you know, right on the clock, take me. You get that little message. So good on you for making the changes. I mean, but mostly in terms of how you were approaching life and who was good for you to be around and all that. And did you find a bit of a feedback loop into your tattoo work and into your creativity? Did that all reinforce your sobriety?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that was a big part of why I decided to become sober was I have plenty of friends that can drink a glass of wine periodically and they're fine. I'm an all or nothing person. Like, I can't just get one tattoo. I have to get my face tattooed. You know, I can't have one drink. So to me, it's all or nothing. And so
right.
I choose nothing because my work, that was something, a promise that I made to myself when I first began tattooing is that I already knew how sacred this was and how important this was to do a great job and to be present. And if there was anything that ever got in the way of that I committed to deleting that. And so when the drinking and drugs and partying and lack of sleep and all that started catching up, it was like, okay, I need to choose at this point. I'm glad I went through it though. And I'm glad I went through it publicly because I remember when I started talking about my sobriety publicly, there were so many people that came out and were like, I don't feel as alone, or, you know, if you can do it, I can do it. And that's just so true. I mean, I'm the biggest addict that you could imagine and I can do it, you know, and I could stick to it. So.
Oh, that's a great role model, but also just the fact that you smile, you're happy, you know, you're not weighed down by the recurring urge or, you know, you get so many images of people who have sort of moved on or gone through a program constantly being in this sort of down, regretful, you know, and you're always positive.
You don't want your recovery to become your identity or just, you know, your crutch. Like, I just want to live my life. And you know, and so there's some people that need it and that's good and that works for them, you know, like going to a program or meetings and things. I've always been a kind of a lone wolf, so it's I thrive better on my own, you know.
Yeah.
So
yeah, absolutely. So yeah. I want to, and I know we don't have endless time because you've got lots of promo on the album coming up, but of course there's this huge chapter in your career becoming an incredibly successful makeup entrepreneur. And, you know, moving through that and, you know, also the role of social media in your life. But two things that don't get enough attention. I mean, one of them did, you know, at the time, but that you're a best-selling author. You have, was it three books?
Yeah.
And each of them made the New York Times best-selling list?
It's interesting because they're kind of like tattoos to me because I wrote them, you know, when I was much younger. And I get scared of reading them now because... You know, you would be reintroducing yourself to an older version of you, you know, or a younger version of you. And I've just grown up so much, like, philosophically, and, you know, I've matured a lot. And so I feel like it would be good to probably write another book before I die, you know, because I think I have, you know, a more mature perspective on things. But again, I'm not ashamed of them or anything like that. But it'd be interesting to read them now because I'm sure I was much more emotional and crazy.
Well, to use one of those words that makes me want to puke, you've grasped adulting with both hands.
Yes.
You know? Anyway, the other thing is that you've actually been a patron of the arts because you actually commissioned the composer Ali Helnwein to write a violin concerto. You're like an Esterhazy, you know, commissioning Haydn to write symphonies.
Well, I'm a huge Ali Helnwein fan. I think he's so talented. And I love that there is like youth in it creating a scene, a music scene around classical music. That's important. I think not only does it keep it alive, but it also brings new life to it. What I like about Ali's work is that it is darker. You know, it's like, it's not just frilly religious music. It's like, you know, it makes you feel. And I think that's what all good music should do. And it's just, I don't know, it's always so impressive when you see somebody young that's so great at something. I know he's busy, just moved on to scoring so many films and projects, and he's doing so great. But that violin concerto was awesome. Like, we put together this beautiful concert for him to release it. And so many people came. And I remember, like, the main violin player was dressed in this crazy skirt that was lit up with lights. And it was just, it was like ear and eye candy, you know?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And yeah, that's something that classical music needs. It needs advocates who are writing music that connect to audiences, that kind of blow the cobwebs out. We talked about that the last time, is people choose their music both because they love the notes, but also because they love the peer group that they associate with it.
Sure.
And classical music has a real peer group image problem.
Well, it's not even the peer group part. I think it's also just the exposure. People don't know about Ollie Helmwein. I don't think as much as they should. I think the classical music world needs to really explode with social media. Everyone else is doing it, you know, and I think that there's mm-hmm. ways of doing it in a very cool way. And I think, like, this podcast and what you're doing is exactly what it needs. More people talking about how classical music pertains to our modern day life.
Exactly. So actually, here's a little challenge, because we also mm-hmm. spoke last time about how the distinctions are kind of artificial and they are not very productive, and anyone can enjoy any kind of music and there's no reason not to give something a try. So as someone who has a toe in both oceans, how would you put in a plug to, let's say, a metal or a goth fan to try Beethoven or Bach? And how would you do the same with a classical music fan to try goth or punk, maybe, or metal?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think on an individual basis, that's pretty easy. If I have somebody coming over to my house, I would just simply play them the song. And, you know, sometimes you just have to, like, see what you've been missing. But but it's interesting, because I feel that, like, a lot of people in the goth scene or in the metal scene, like, they already are very responsive to classical music. You wouldn't really necessarily know it, but they're into that. I mean, every vampire movie, there's one of the same songs that's always playing. I think it's a Mozart song.
Right.
That's always, you know, the...
Probably the Dies Irae from the Requiem, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So it's already playing as a soundtrack of our lives. I would love to see more people like Ollie Helmwein get onto the scene, you know, and start mm-hmm. putting forward music in that same manner.
So did you just sort of wake up one day and say, I love this guy's music, pick up the phone, Ollie, write me a concerto? Was that the way it worked?
Actually, we became friends, and at the time I was dating a guy, and he was turning 50, and so for his 50th birthday, My boyfriend at the time was in a band, so I commissioned Ollie to do a concerto version of all of his hits, and we hired some string players to be at the entrance of his birthday party. It was like this very elegant 50th birthday, and so that's how we first started working together.
Mm.
And then after that, we actually started working on a few projects, and the violin concerto was one of them. Yeah.
Well, I hope that concerto gets performed a lot more widely. I've heard pieces of it, not the whole thing, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And it sounds like a really terrific piece. And by the way, for you orchestra folks out there, it's a chamber orchestra, so it's not that expensive to put on.
Yeah, true. It's true.
How did you make the transition into the world of makeup? I mean, that is, in a way, I can see related to tattooing.
No, I think that it was just mainly that I was on a TV show, and I think that a company noticed me and noticed that people were responding to my aesthetic that was a lot different than what anything else that was going on at the time. And so they approached me about doing a few shades of lipstick, and then it ended up just blowing up. And then, you know, 12 years later, I ended up selling the makeup line and making room to be able to go on tour. You know, I think I have like a love and hate relationship with it. I always have with makeup, because, again, I always like to use it as a form of self-expression. And I think that when I started the makeup line, that's what it was about. And then I think once you get so big and it becomes corporate, it's like you lose control of the direction, and what's dictating the creative is no longer the art, and it's about sales. And it was heartbreaking. I don't want to contribute mm-hmm. to that, you know, to certain ideals of beauty that aren't really aligned with how I see
right.
the world, you know, and those are indicators of red flags to move on to something else that you will have control over But you know, I'm proud of what I did within that decade. I think I made some pretty cool stuff.
Yep. Well, and also alongside your tattooing work and your television exposure, you built a huge community, and that sort of leads into your life in social media, because I think across your various platforms, you've got, what is it, about 19 million followers, and it sounds like they've stayed steadfast and loyal, even though you're, you know, sort of in your post-makeup life. So that's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
How did that engagement start?
I was always very confused by social media. Like, why would anybody care what other people are doing, you know? And my sister was the one that, I think she started me with Twitter or something. And I was like, what do you write? People are writing about their lattes. I'm like, I don't care about what you're drinking, you know? And I was like, okay, well, just like anything else, I think there's a million ways of doing one thing. And you can bring art to it. So that's how I started doing it. It's like I was sharing a lot of music. I started a Song of the Day post and tried to like hyper focus on like independent musicians that weren't really known that well. And then sharing other artists and things that inspired me. But ultimately, I just like to post things that I love. You know, like I think that's, as long as you're sincere about things, it's like people will respond in the right way. And sometimes it's better to grow it slowly than, you know, just trying to get a bunch of followers for the wrong reasons. You know, I think I see a lot of people doing that, and I want nothing to do with that.
Yeah. But on the other hand, the dark side to social media, and anyone who's in the political realm obviously has experienced that, because either if you become someone who's important in people's online lives, they feel like in a way they own you or you owe them, or they are hypercritical. And it seems as though there's a faction of that world that only sort of exists to live in judgment, you know, so they're looking for something that they can jump on.
Of course, yeah.
And you've been through that. I mean, was that painful to experience?
Yeah, partially. I mean, I don't really allow those things to have power over my life. And that can get challenging sometimes when it's in your face, you know. But I have learned that you're just not able to share everything. I think there are some things that you just keep to yourself because it's just, you won't win. And I think it's okay that not everybody likes you. You know, I think it would be weird if everybody liked me. I mean, I do block people. I block people if they're negative. I think negativity feeds more negativity, and I won't allow space for that. I don't know. Sometimes I wonder if people would really like me if they really knew how I really felt about a lot of things, you know, and those things I just keep to myself. I don't agree with a lot of the things that are happening politically and all that stuff. I've always just been like an advocate and a huge supporter of free speech. And it feels like we don't have that anymore. You know, I think if someone doesn't like what you have to say, like you just get canceled, or someone starts a campaign against you. And I don't think that's the right way to treat each other. You know, I don't think that's the golden rule.
We certainly can disagree and disagree vigorously. We can even find people's opinions highly objectionable. But if you basically freeze them out of public space, their opinions aren't going to change. They're just going to become more obsessed with those views. And if those views are destructive, you know, essentially what you're doing is saying, I don't want to see it. So let it just grow over there where I don't have to think about it until it explodes. It doesn't seem like a winning strategy to me, but you're right. We have it.
Yeah, same.
We have it.
But I think when it comes to social media, there are some people that I see living very unhealthy amounts of time invested into their social media. Like I have friends that sometimes, not very many, but I have a few friends that like, they just can't focus. You know, they just want to, they're constantly hyper-checking all the time. And we've just chosen not to do that. You know,
right.
We like post something, engage for a few minutes, and then we live our life. And I'm not going to sit here and obsess about comments. And especially I think with the music, like this is a new realm for me because I'm releasing my own music for the first time. And I expect not everybody's going to like what I make, and that's okay,
right.
You know, or people might, you might not like my voice. It's a preference thing, you know,
right.
But you just have to be prepared for that one person in the audience that's with their arms crossed, not enjoying themselves, and not make that your audience. You know what I mean? And forget the rest of the people that are cheering. So
this is an issue that I lived through when I had my own record label, you know, that you have to basically try to remind people that there's a difference between music and religion, and that even if you don't like it, I wasn't out to harm anybody. You know, I didn't try to do a bad thing. I've got a book to recommend for you if you can get a copy. I don't know if it's in print, but I'm sure you can find a used copy. It's called The Lexicon of Musical Invective, and it's basically a collection of all the horrible reviews that Beethoven got and Franz Liszt got and Chopin got all the way through to the 20th century. It's edited by a guy who was an avant-garde composer himself called Nicholas Leninsky, who went on to collaborate with Frank Zappa, actually. Zappa discovered him and said, "Hey, man, I love the stuff you were writing in the 1930s, so come out on stage at a stadium concert." It's a book that will help you to prepare for anything negative that might come your way. I think you'd love that.
I would love to read that.
Yeah.
Cool. You know, I was going to say one thing, though, and this in no way is a plug for my music, but I've always loved when people cover contemporary music into classical. So I do plan on releasing sheet music for my album once the album comes out. And I know that you have such a great following in the classical world. So if anybody out there, once we release this, feels inspired to do, you know, a classical rendition of stuff, I just can't wait to hear that. I think that would be so amazing.
All right. All you string quartets out there, you woodwind trios. And you orchestras, you know where to come. Just, yeah, we'll post a link. You give us a link to post.
Cool.
And we'll do that.
I love that.
Kat, I really enjoyed this. Obviously, you know, we could go into so many things, you know, your love of Beethoven. Do you still have your Beethoven tattoo? I know you've been blacking out, right?
No. I would never black out my Beethoven tattoos.
Oh, that's great. They're amazing. Amazing.
Yeah.
So this is a new look. Parts of you are no longer as illustrated as they were, right?
Yeah. No, I started covering up a lot of my tattoos, mainly just the ones that were like from back when I was drinking and, you know, making a chaos on my arms.
So, I'm glad to know that Ludwig is still there. And, you know,
yes.
I'm going to say again, you know, one of these days, if you want to get a Glenn tattoo, you know,
yes.
we'll feature it, you know.
I love that.
We'll
I love that.
The video. And we have a
cool.
date for you to give me my first ever tattoo.
I'm ready whenever you are, Brian.
All right, fabulous. And folks, check out Kat's music. You know, her books, you can still find them. The main thing that I find really fascinating about Kat's work is she really doesn't see artificial divisions between any area of creativity. And she always approaches everything with a huge amount of energy. Like, you know, I hope you don't mind my saying this, but like you're a six-year-old child discovering something for the first time. So it's like,
I love that.
You know, and I love that. So even though you're adulting, you know, you still basically, you can meet Leofar on an equal footing in discovering the world.
Most definitely.
Oh, thanks so much for being with
cool.
us, Kat.
Oh, no, thank you. Thank you so much. I always enjoy our time together.
There's a picture.
Well, friends, that was our conversation with the multifaceted Kat Von D. She is a woman of many talents and interests. You can catch her debut album, Love Made Me Do It. It's available as of August 27th. I know that her friends and her admirers are going to discover a new musical side to Kat with this album. And Olivia, did you learn anything new that you didn't know before about Kat?
Yeah, knowing Kat as a tattoo artist and watching her growing up on LA Ink, it's interesting to hear a little bit more about her background, her family, and her musicality. I think it's pretty remarkable. She's an excellent musician, and excited to hear this new album as well, especially with the collaborations with Dave Grohl and others.
Absolutely. And of course, it's through her classical background that we came to know Kat. You can go online to her Instagram and find a wonderful picture that she had taken during a visit to Toronto, where she called a halt to her schedule, made a beeline to the Glenn Gould studio in downtown Toronto so that she could take a picture of herself on the famous Glenn Gould Park bench sculpture. That was followed by a beautiful portrait drawing that she also posted on her Instagram, and it's really another side of her artistic life.
She's a Glenn admirer just like you and I, Brian.
Yeah, so it seems. Okay, thank you again, friends, and welcome again to Season 2 of The Gould Standard. We have many wonderful guests to come. Please join us. And Olivia, do you have some information to share with our friends?
Yes, of course. If you would like to follow us on social media, you can find us everywhere at the Glenn Gould Foundation. And if you check out glenngould.ca, you can find all of the different projects we are working on at the moment. And of course, we are a registered Canadian charity, and you will find some information there on how to give if you are so inclined.
Thank you again, folks, and we'll see you soon.
Thanks, folks.